Friendship is for Whom?
Yeah. This guy's been trying to strangle me for 10 years. He'll succeed one of these days. Talking about current peace negotiations is obviously speculation. My assumption in general is that policy decisions grow out of interests. The interests are rooted in institutional structures. These don't really change very much over long periods. And in fact, U.S. policy on this issue grows out of commitments and concerns and attitudes and ideology that go way back, in fact, back to the 1920s when the U.S. became involved in the region. I'm not going to try to, and I really think, I hope this doesn't seem too far out of line to you, but I would like to sketch just a couple of the high points of the background, which is very much misunderstood. I don't know of any topic which has been so grossly misreported, not only in the press, but in the scholarly literature and elsewhere. I'm not going to obviously give footnotes, but if you want, if you're interested, I'd be happy to refer you to some sources. I think to understand the current situation, we really have to see out of what it grew. Let's just go back to 1967. In November 1967, there was the first major UN Security Council resolution was passed, UN 242. That expressed a certain international consensus on how the conflict ought to be settled. Now, like every resolution, this one was left a little vague so that everybody could sign it, interpreting it their own way. And there are several interpretations, but we understand pretty well what the interpretations were. And in fact, even in the last few months, some new and important documentation has come out about the actual U.S. position at that time. I'm sure you all know this, but the resolution called for a settlement on the Green Line, the former internationally recognized borders, the pre-June borders, with possibly some minor modifications. And the U.S. position, and in fact the world position, was that if there were modifications, they would have to be mutual adjustments. In fact, the Arab states agreed to sign the UN, agreed to U-242, we now know, and we didn't know as recently as 8 months ago, because they received the assurances from the U.S. negotiator Arthur Goldberg and Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, who's recently reconfirmed this, and the State Department, again, recently reconfirmed that the U.S. would support mutual adjustments if there were, which would in any event be minor. So in effect, a settlement on the pre-June 67 borders, the Green Line. That was also the position of essentially pretty much the entire world. Notice that the UN 242 offered nothing to the Palestinians. I mean, they're mentioned only as refugees. And that, in fact, was the international consensus of the time, including the Arab states. The U.S. position was firmed up in December 1969 with the Rogers Plan. Rogers was Secretary of State, which just repeated what I just said, basically. And that was the official U.S. position, and we know from the documentary record that that was also the internal position. Now, that remained so until February 1971. In February 1971, an extremely important event took place. It's kind of out of history, but it took place. UN had a mediator, Gunnar Jarring, who was trying to establish a settlement, and Jarring made a proposal pretty much along the lines of UN 242, in fact, almost as interpreted as I just described it, and President Sadat of Egypt accepted it. Israel's response was that they welcomed President Sadat's offer of it as a genuine peace offer, but they decided to reject it. We know from internal discussion in Hebrew literature that they felt that if they held out, they could get much better territorial concessions. At that point, the U.S. had to make a decision. The U.S. is overwhelmingly the dominant power in the region. After the Second World War, the U.S. in effect extended the Monroe Doctrine to the Middle East, which is a very important fact, incidentally. In fact, part of the significance of the Gulf War is that the Gulf War there was a change. For the first time, Europe has essentially accepted this. they've excluded themselves and accepted that this is U.S. turf and they're not allowed to interfere, which is a change and a significant one. But in any event, the U.S. was the overwhelmingly powerful actor there. And the U.S. had to make a decision. Is the U.S. going to support its own official policy, or is it going to back Israel? And there was a policy split over that. The policy split was more or less symbolized by an open conflict between William Rogers, Secretary of State, and Henry Kissinger, who was National Security Advisor. Kissinger's position was what he called stalemate, no changes. It just freeze things the way they are. There were all kind of reasons for this, you know, ranging from personal to strategic. But anyway, that was the conflict. Kissinger won. The U.S. decided to back Israel's rejection of the 1971 offer. And that was the first time that the peace process was aborted. Now, that also incidentally, by accident, happens to be the month when George Bush reached national prominence, appointed as UN ambassador. From then till today, the U.S. has continued to block every step, every effort towards peace. Every effort to achieve peace has been blocked by the United States. It has adhered to this position. There is not the slightest evidence that George Bush ever had the slightest qualms about this, or that he does today. I mention that because I think it bears on what's happening now. Kissinger assumed, as the U.S. intelligence and Israeli intelligence assumed, that Israel was overwhelmingly powerful. This was a period of tremendous triumphalism. The head of Israeli military intelligence, Yoshafat Harkabi, who now is a dove, was then an extreme hawk and expressed the position saying that war is not the Arabs' game. We don't have to worry about that anymore. And that was the standard view. Tremendous triumphalism. It was assumed that Israel could just maintain its position and nobody would bother them. And, you know, Ariel Sharon, the right-wing general, stated at the time that Israel could conquer everything from Baghdad to Khartoum to Morocco in a week if they wanted to, but they don't want to. And that was the general understanding. On those grounds, Kissinger's, along with the big strategic conception behind it, Kissinger's position is understandable. And I stress again, the U.S. has not veered from that position since, except in detail, and I don't think it's veering from it now. The Kissinger's backing of Israel's refusal of any diplomatic moves, which continued, that led directly to the 1973 war. Egypt continued to warn, Sadat continued to warn, that if the U.S. blocked every diplomatic initiative, they would have no recourse but to go to war. Nobody took them seriously. Everybody laughed. 1973 war came along, and it was understood that it wasn't a joke. War was the Arabs' game, but a pretty close call. Well, at that point, the United States made a tactical modification of policy. Since Egypt could not be ignored, it wasn't a basket case, you go to the fallback position. Fallback position is absorb them into the U.S. system. For years, Sadat had been offering to make Egypt a U.S. client state. That's all he wanted, just make us your client state. So Kissinger agreed to that. The United States agreed to that, finally, after the war, and moved to the position, to a very natural fallback position. You can't ignore them, therefore marginalize them. And that leads to the next step, which was consummated at Camp David in 1978-79. Exclude Egypt from the conflict, since we can't ignore them. Exclude them from the conflict, which means a Sinai settlement. Increase military and economic support to Israel. Back Israel in its plans to integrate the occupied territories and attack its northern neighbor, Lebanon. That was the obvious meaning of Kissinger's diplomacy and of the Camp David Agreement. Whether Jimmy Carter understood it or not, I don't know, but it was certainly the obvious meaning. Egypt was the only Arab deterrent. If you eliminate them from the conflict and you give Israel a huge increase in support, of course they're going to do exactly what they intend to do. What else could happen? And what they intended to do was exactly what they did, move to integrate the occupied territories and invade Lebanon, which was done in 1978, and then extensive bombing through the next couple of years, and then again in 1982, as you know. Well, what was predictable happened, not surprisingly, meanwhile, another event had taken place, a diplomatic non-event had taken place of some significance. In January 1976, another event took place that's out of history but real and important. In January 1976, the UN Security Council debated a resolution which updated 242. In effect, it updated 242 by essentially the same as 242, except it added one thing, namely a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Well, that reflected a changed international consensus having to do with the Palestinian movement and all sorts of things. But by then, virtually the entire world had shifted its position. It adopted the same position on borders, but with a Palestinian state in the occupied territories instead of returning the West Bank to Jordan and the Gaza Strip to Egypt, which it had administered before. That resolution was brought to the Security Council by the Arab confrontation states, so-called, by Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. It was publicly supported by the PLO, and according to Israel's delegation, Chaim Herzog was then ambassador, it was actually prepared by the PLO. That I can't know for sure, but it was certainly publicly supported by them. It was supported by the whole world. The United States vetoed it. That ended that. That's the next step in destruction of the peace process. The U.S. was not going to accept this modification of UN 242, which recognized Palestinian self-determination, even though at that point the U.S. was moving to integrate Egypt within the U.S. orbit, to accept Sadat's offer to make it a client state, and to exclude it from the conflict with the Sinai settlement so that Israel could then go on to do what it continued to do. Well, that continued. A little deviation now and then, but basically that continued. The U.S. vetoed a similar resolution in 1980. There was a series of proposals through the early 80s from Arab states, from the PLO, from the European community, from just about every source, to try to move towards a diplomatic settlement. Israel refused. The U.S. rejected it, flat out. No moves on this, hence no peace process. There has been no peace process since February 1971 for exactly this reason. You can see, without running through the whole record, you can see what it means if you look at the UN record. It's almost never published, but the facts are very dramatic. The Security Council is out because the U.S. has already made it clear it'll veto anything. The General Assembly, there's no technical veto, but of course if the U.S. votes against something, it amounts to a veto given its power. There's a vote every year. Every winter session of the UN, there's a vote which essentially reiterates the content of these resolutions. The vote passes, well, December 1990 was the most recent one. It was 144-2. December 1989, it was 151-3 for some unexplained reason. Dominica joined the United States and Israel, probably some payoff. In 1988, it was 138-2, and that's the way it is every year. That's the peace process. Nothing can happen as long as the U.S. blocks it, and the U.S. has always blocked the peace process. Well, the U.S. was quite pleased with the status quo, accepted the status quo up until early 1988. When the Intifada broke out, it was beginning to cause unacceptable costs to Israel, and that means to the United States, Israel's U.S. client. And there were problems. One problem was just the cost of one problem was the PR cost. For the first time, some information started coming out about, in fact, what had always been going on. It was getting harder to suppress. So the press was giving, for a couple of months at least, some indication of the regular events in that in the occupied territories and the character of the occupation and so on. It made it very hard to maintain the pretense of a benign occupation and all that stuff. Furthermore, it was just plain costly. Israel's army was virtually dissociated from every action except suppressing the Intifada, which was pretty tricky for them. It was costing the U.S. It was also a diplomatic cost. It was becoming harder and harder to suppress the PLO's offers. Now, right through the 80s, there continued to be offers from Yasser Arafat and the PLO calling for negotiations leading to mutual recognition. The American press, with just astonishing discipline, didn't report these things. New York Times was an absolute blackout, refused totally. Other papers, you'd occasionally get a little hint of it here and there. It's quite a remarkable story. I have a full record of it if you're interested. Anyhow, by 1988, it was getting really hard. The offers were very insistent, they were very clear, they were very public, they were being made all over Europe, and you just couldn't. It was getting harder and harder to pretend it wasn't happening. by the end of 1988, the U.S. was really getting into a bind. You remember back then, the United States was claiming that Arafat had not yet said the magic words. He hadn't repeated, you know, we told him to say XYZ, and he said, you know, XYZW or something. And therefore, we couldn't proceed. Well, the United States was becoming a laughing stock. Literally, it was becoming a diplomatic joke in Europe and elsewhere, with George Shultz going around about how you haven't said the magic words, we can't talk to them. It reached a real danger point in November, December 1988. The United States refused to allow Arafat to speak at the UN. The UN moved to Geneva, which is a real slap in the face, spoke there. At that point, the U.S. decided to move to another fallback position, and that brings us into the contemporary period. The decision was to pretend that Arafat had taken the U.S. position, said the magic words, and then to insist that that's their stand because we say so. In fact, what Arafat said at that famous press conference was as different from the U.S. position as it had always been. And it could, no Palestinian spokesman could possibly take the U.S. position, which was hopeless. But the U.S. is a very powerful state, sort of dominates the international propaganda apparatus. And once the U.S. announced Arafat had taken our position, that became a fact, even though it wasn't true. PLO accepted it too, sort of, I should say. After the pretense that Arafat had said the magic words, the U.S. then gave them the reward. The reward was that they could start low-level negotiations with the U.S. ambassador in Tunis. That was the so-called dialogue. The purpose of the dialogue was extremely clear. The first meeting of the dialogue was leaked and published in Egypt and published in Israel and, in fact, even published in the English-language press in Israel, which meant that every reporter read it. And what it said is this. The U.S. announced its position in the first meeting. The position was, no American newspaper was willing to touch this, I should say. The U.S. position was announced in the first meeting. It said, we have two demands. Demand number one, there will be no international conference. So forget about it. No peace process. Demand number two, call off the Intifada, which we regard as terrorism against, they said call off the riots, which we regard as terrorism against the state of Israel. So in other words, forget about any peace process. Return to the previous status quo, and then we'll be willing to talk to you. That was the U.S. position. Israel understood perfectly what was going on. 2 months later, in February 1989, this was the Labor Party government at the time, the Minister of Defense, Yitzhak Rabin, that was responsible for the occupied territories, had a meeting with several five Peace Now leaders in Israel. And we put it in the Hebrew press. He told them, don't worry about the dialogue. It's a good thing. We're not opposed to it. It's a low-level dialogue, which has absolutely no meaning. The point of the dialogue is to give us, he said, a year or more to crush the Intifada by force. And we will do it. And he said, they will be crushed. Don't worry about it. If the Peace Now leaders had any objection to this, it wasn't reported. The only thing they were reported to have said was various tactical questions about whether it was going to work. Well, that was the Israeli understanding, and it was also the U.S. government understanding, and that was the role of the dialogue. Keep things quiet so Israel can step up the pressure while the world's attention is directed elsewhere, and they will be crushed, which is incidentally what happened, within about a year, in fact. Meanwhile, to deflect the danger of any further diplomatic moves, the U.S. and Israel initiated their own diplomatic initiative. That came in May 1989, with the what's called the Shamir Plan, although bear in mind that there was then a Labor-Likud coalition government, and it was actually the coalition plan. It was the Shamir-Peres Plan. That was announced in May 1989. That's the official U.S. Israeli plan. It's also the official U.S. government plan because the United States announced immediately that we were going to support the Shamir Plan. That was the only plan on the table, as James Baker put it. The Baker Plan came out a couple of months later, officially the State Department bulletin. It said the only issue under discussion, the only topic under discussion, is the Shamir Plan. Any Palestinians who are permitted into negotiations will be allowed to discuss the modalities of the Shamir Plan and nothing else. That's the official Baker Plan, official U.S. policy, December 1989. Well, what's the Shamir Plan? its terms have never been published in the American press, except, you know, the marginal press, the magazine or something. Although it's there, you know, you can get a copy of it from the Israeli embassy if you like, or you can read it in, you know, alternative press publications. And it is official U.S. government policy. It says it has three basic premises. Basic premise number one is there can be no additional Palestinian state. That means there already is a Palestinian state, it's Jordan. There can't be an additional Palestinian state. So there's no issue of Palestinian self-determination, contrary to what the Palestinians and the Jordanians and the rest of the world mistakenly believe. We have established that fact. And when the U.S. takes a position, that does establish the fact. I mean, that's the way power works. So point number one, there can be no additional Palestinian state in addition to Jordan. Point number two, I'm quoting, there can be no change in the status of the occupied territories of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, except in accordance with the basic guidelines of the Israeli government, and you know what they are. Point number three, basic premise number three, the PLO is excluded, meaning Palestinians are not even permitted to choose their own representatives to sign the capitulation. Then point number four, which is the forthcoming one, says there will be what they call free elections held under Israeli military occupation with the Palestinian leadership rotting in jail, you know, under administrative detention. Well, you know, if anybody else were to propose something like that, we wouldn't even bother laughing. We'd probably nuke them or something. But that, the fourth point is the one that was made public and tremendously forthcoming. We're going to allow free elections under military occupation. That's the Shamir Peres plan. That's the Baker plan. Well, that carries us up until 1990. And since then, it's simply been reiterated. The Gulf War comes along. Its major effect was to establish U.S. hegemony over the, forceful hegemony over the region. Something you pointed out correctly that this was a preventable war, but the U.S. had a big stake in ensuring that that war wasn't prevented. That established the rule of force in the region, and the rule of diplomatic settlement would have been of no use to the United States. There were looked like real possibilities for a diplomatic settlement. The U.S. would not permit it. It had to be settled by force. That's our strong card. You naturally play your strong card. The end result was establishment of the principle that this is U.S. turf. Nobody interferes, nobody indigenous, nobody foreign. Europe has kind of backed off and withdrawn, and now the U.S. runs it unilaterally. Well, we now come up to Madrid. Looking back over the record, there are two reasons why the U.S. has vetoed every Security Council resolution and, in effect, vetoed every General Assembly resolution by voting against it, which amounts to a veto. They always have two points which are unacceptable to the United States. Point number one is there'll be an international conference. Now, the U.S. won't accept that because this is U.S. turf. Nobody's allowed in, certainly not our rivals. Kissinger, incidentally, made that very clear in private discussions that were then leaked through the Freedom of Information Act. He said that a major commitment of his diplomacy was to keep Europe and Japan out of any involvement in the Middle East, and that makes sense. Control over, dominance over the major energy resources of the world is an extremely powerful lever in world affairs, quite apart from the huge profits that flow from it, and the U.S. wants that for itself. That's one of the ways you keep your rivals under control. So no Europe and Japan, it's our place, the Monroe Doctrine. So that's point one. Point two is that the international, the peace process, as the world has seen it, has always called for Palestinian self-determination in some fashion, you know, state or whatever, and the U.S. is against that. The U.S. is opposed to it, I'll come back to why, but it is definitely opposed to it. There's not the slightest indication of any modification on this, and I think the reasons are deeply rooted. And therefore, the U.S. has had to stop every effort at a peace process and has done so. That comes right up till today. Well, what happens when we come to Madrid? Notice that the two U.S. conditions are satisfied. It is a unilateral conference. Nobody else is allowed in. I mean, the Russians, Gorbachev was invited, but that was a joke. That's just to make it, you know, the only reason Gorbachev was invited because he was the powerless leader of a non-existent state. So therefore, you could have editorials calling it an international conference. But anybody who existed was not going to be allowed in. You know, again, sort of not very subtle point. It's a U.S.-run unilateral initiative. People do what the U.S. says. So that satisfies point number one. far as point number two is concerned, there is no even nod given to any matter of Palestinian self-determination. What the Palestinians are being offered is essentially the Shamir Plan. Now, the Shamir Plan has a couple of variations. Labor and Likud, the two major parties, over the years have had slightly different interpretations of how to maintain control over the territories. The Likud, which is called the hawkish group, nobody calls for annexation. Very important to bear that in mind. Nobody has ever, even the most, you know, greater Israel enthusiasts don't call for annexation. There's a very well understood reason for that. It's constantly discussed in the Israeli press, but it's perfectly understandable. If you annex the territories, it is necessary to extend Israeli law to them, and that means you have to provide to the population the minimal services that are available to second-class citizens within Israel. And that's a very expensive business. You know, like Arabs in Israel, Israeli Arab citizens are second-class, but, you know, there's some limits, like they can't just die in the streets and that sort of thing. So there's minimal standards that are offered them, and nobody wants to pay the cost of extending that to the population in the territories. The current situation is much better. They're very heavily taxed, and they're given no services in return. So that's perfect. And therefore, you don't want to extend, you don't want to annex. Therefore, they have this ambiguous phrase, extend sovereignty. Nobody knows exactly what that means. But that's the hawkish position. The dovish position, what's here called the dovish position, the Labor Party position, is something called territorial compromise, or land for peace, which sounds very nice until you look at what it means. And what it means is basically the same as the Likud position. It means Israel takes whatever it wants in the occupied territories, takes the usable land, the resources, the Jordan Valley, any of the suburbs around, you know, what are in effect the Tel Aviv, Jerusalem suburbs and the hills, takes whatever it likes, but it does not take responsibility for the heavy Arab population concentrations. It's like it doesn't take Nablus. Well, that's just another way of saying we take what we feel like, but we don't want responsibility for the population. The population can either be stateless, or they can be administered by Jordan, but we don't want responsibility for them. That's called land for peace and territorial compromise. When you see those nice words, that's what they mean. The difference between the Likud and the Labor position is very slight. In fact, plenty of Palestinian nationalists, and in fact even Israeli doves, regard the Likud position as better. The Likud position is autonomy, you know, under Israeli sovereignty. And their assumption is, so for example, Shmuel Toledano, kind of a labored dove, says the Likud position is better because at least Israel has some kind of responsibility for the population, whereas under the Labor territorial compromise position, population can just drop dead. Nobody has any responsibility for them. And in fact, the worst thing in the world is to be stateless. You know, nothing worse than that. And those are the choices. The U.S. Is now pressing either land for peace or autonomy. That's one or the other of these two positions. They're very slightly different. The definition of autonomy was given rather succinctly by one of the best Israeli journalists, Danny Rubenstein, in Haaretz, which is kind of like the New York Times, you know, the official paper. He's a very good journalist. He's not no particular dove, incidentally. He's pretty mainstream. But he's been doing some of the best coverage of the occupied territories for years, and he knows Israeli policy well, and a couple of articles recently in which he pointed out that what Israel and the United States are offering the Palestinians, he said, is autonomy, but it's the autonomy of a POW camp, in which the prisoners are autonomous to cook their own meals and run their own cultural events, and that's the end of it. We're not going to under autonomy, they get nothing. In fact, he ended up saying, under autonomy, they're going to have about what they have now. Run their own educational system, run their own health services, because Israel doesn't want to pay for it. And that'll be called autonomy. Meanwhile, Israel will pick up what it likes. And that's the U.S. position, too, as far as I know. If there's any modification of U.S. policy on this, I haven't found one particle of evidence for it. So my assumption is that that's the way it stands, the way it's been for years. The reason the U.S. is pushing the peace process now is so-called peace process. I mean, my view is a war process, is twofold. First of all, it looks like there might be an opportunity to advance the traditional U.S. rejectionism, to really move it a couple of steps forward. You know, it's unilateral unilateral conference. Nobody else is allowed in. It's based on the U.S. principle that there can't be any Palestinian self-determination, and maybe you can make some progress on this. Maybe after the Gulf War, the leaders of the Arab oil monarchies will be able to be more public in what has always been their tacit support for Israeli power. That's one of the hidden secrets of the region, that there's always been a kind of a tacit alliance between the monarchs who run the oil system for the United States and England, and Israel, which is part of the protective apparatus, goes back to the 1960s. But they've never been able to do it publicly because there's too much public, you know, pressure. For Palestinians, were always a live issue, the unresolved nationalist issue. And one feeling is, well, after the Gulf War, secular nationalism is discredited and people are, you know, sort of destroyed, you know, smashed up, so maybe you can move this a couple of steps forward. The other reason is that the U.S. administration desperately needs a political victory, a significant political victory. There are a lot of reasons for this, but the most obvious is that the Gulf War was a total catastrophe from the point of view of the United States itself. You know, the end result of the war is unacceptable politically. The U.S., remember, ended, first of all, killed a couple hundred thousand people and destroyed the place, and they ended up supporting Saddam Hussein. In fact, the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein as he crushed the popular rebellions, the Shiite and the Kurdish rebellions, and that was for good reasons, which were for once explained in the press. The reasons were that, as Thomas Friedman, the chief diplomatic correspondent of the Times, put it, the U.S. wants to achieve the best of all worlds. The best of all worlds would be a military junta in Iraq, which would wield the iron fist just the way Saddam Hussein did prior to August 1990, much to the satisfaction of the U.S. allies, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and of course the boss in Washington. He didn't ask to add the last phrase, but that's tacit. That is the U.S. position. Therefore, the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein as he crushed the rebellions, and we did support him. You know, it reached the point where Iraqi generals trying to join the Shiite rebellion pleaded with American military a couple of miles away not to do anything, just to allow them to have Iraqi captured equipment that they could use in the fight against Saddam Hussein, and General Schwarzkopf refused. George Bush was off fishing. That was the U.S. position. And it doesn't look pretty. You know, it's going to be pretty hard to sell politically. So you have to show that some great thing happened as a result of this, and there's been a huge propaganda campaign about how, well, you know, maybe we didn't do too well in the Gulf, didn't come out perfect, but we can still win this sweet victory, we're now going to advance the peace process, you know, so on. So there are domestic political reasons, and there are just strategic reasons of advancing traditional policies. So the U.S. certainly wants to push this as much as possible, and that's where we now stand. Now, what's the reasoning that lies behind it? Well, I don't think that's very obscure. Like I said, that goes back to the 1920s. In fact, it kind of goes back to British imperialism, which the U.S. took over for after the Second World War. The British imperial managers, back at the time of the First World War, recognized that it was going to be economically and politically and militarily impossible for them to run the region as colonies. It was just, they didn't have the forces or the economic strength or whatever. So Lord Curzon and the Parliamentary Committee and so on, you look back at their records, internal records now pretty well public, they concluded that what Britain ought to do is establish what they call an Arab facade. That is, a facade of Arab rulers behind whom the imperial power, Britain, would run the show, and as Lord Curzon put it, Britain should disguise absorption of the colonies under convenient fictions such as buffer state or sphere of influence or something like that. In other words, set up effectively a colonial system but behind an Arab facade. Well, when the U.S. took over the same scene after the Second World War, incidentally kicking Britain out, which it didn't want to do, but the U.S. was the stronger of the two. When the U.S. took over, it essentially adopted the same strategic conception. The main interest is control over the oil system. It's not that the U.S. needs the oil. I mean, the U.S. could be on solar energy and we'd have the same policies. In fact, until around 1970, we were an exporter. We were the world's largest exporter in North America. So it's not that the U.S. needs the oil, but what it does need is the leverage and the prophets. And again, the documentary record, insofar as it's available, makes it very clear that all tremendous profits come out of oil production, and you got to make sure that they flow to the economies of the United States and its British client, which is what it is. So Kuwaiti investments are in London, and Saudi Arabian profits come back to, you know, treasury securities and prop up the U.S. economy and so on. That's a very important one thing that maintains the wealth and integrity of the U.S. economy, which is quite a serious problem now. I mean, I don't have to tell you. So for those reasons, the U.S. has got to ensure that the energy system remains under U.S. control. You can't, it's just not cost effective to try to run it directly, so we have an Arab facade. The Arab facade is the family dictatorships who were handed the management of the energy system in the Anglo-American imperial settlement. They've got to be protected against any threat. The threats are all indigenous. There's no threat from anywhere else. They have to be protected against nationalist movements and, you know, uprisings and so on. How do you protect your Arab facade, you know, the various dictators and tyrants who manage the system for you? Well, there's two levels of protection. One level is a group of regional enforcers, preferably non-Arab, because non-Arabs just find it easier to kill Arabs. So there's a periphery of regional enforcers. It includes Turkey, Israel, Iran under the Shah, Pakistan, which provides a kind of Praetorian guard for the Saudi elite and so on. Their job is to protect the facade from the population. That's how the U.S. relation with Israel actually got firmed up in the 1960s. Israel was regarded by U.S. intelligence as a barrier against Arab nationalist pressure against the Gulf rulers. Coming from Nasser at that time. That's when the Israeli-Saudi alliance got essentially established. Iran, you know, had some problems when the Shah was lost, but they'd like to work that one back in. Well, that's the second level. And then in the background, there's British and American muscle, in case anything really goes wrong. Come in. The two violent warrior states come in and take care of things in case you get in trouble. Well, now, in that strategic conception, as far as I can see, has not changed at all. Beyond that, there's only tactical judgments as to how to work it out. Now, in that system, people, you know, some state, say, or group, has value insofar as they contribute to the system. Well, who has value? Naturally, the Arab facade. The family dictatorships have value because they manage it for us. They're the facade. The enforcer states, like Turkey and Israel and so on, they have value because, you know, they're the local muscle. U.S. obviously has value. We don't have to worry about that. What about Palestinians? Now, they offer nothing to the system. They don't have wealth. They don't have power. Actually, they're negative because they're a disruptive element that stirs up nationalist forces. As a result, they simply have no rights. I mean, it's kind of elementary. If you don't contribute something to power, you have no human rights. That's just statecraft, it's called. So accordingly, it's entirely natural that the U.S. should always oppose any form of Palestinian self-determination, and it does. And as far as I can see, it still does. Well, we're now up till today, my picture is that Danny Rubenstein's story is essentially correct, that the U.S. and Israel intend to offer either some kind of autonomy or maybe call it territorial compromise, which will ensure that Israel has central control of whatever it needs or wants in the territories. I think this, if it can be achieved, it will be, in my view, with the not only acceptance but even approval of the tyrants who rule the oil system, the Arab tyrannies, and of course the other enforcer states, Turkey and so on, with the U.S. in the background. Well, whether it can work or not, that's now we're in the area of speculation. But if there's a change from this framework, I haven't seen any evidence of it.